Thank you very much, Jason. I'll now introduce our third and final speaker for this panel, Dr. Luke Sheehan. Dr. Sheehan is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Duquesne University, a senior affiliate in the Program for Research on Religion and Urban Civil Society at the University of Pennsylvania, President of the Academy of Philosophy and Letters, and editor of the University Bookman. He researches the intersection of the First Amendment and civil society. He is the author of Why Associations Matter, The Case for First Amendment Pluralism, and editor of International Comparative Approaches to Free Speech and Open Inquiry. Professor Sheehan's articles have appeared in Humanitas, The Political Science Reviewer, Perspectives on Political Science, National Affairs, Law and Liberty, Real Clear Civics, and other venues. Before coming to Duquesne, he held academic appointments at Duke University and Wellesley College, where he was Associate Director of an academic institute. He is the recipient of the Humane Studies Fellowship, the Richard M. Weaver Fellowship from ISI, the Leonard Ligia Memorial Fellowship from the Philadelphia Society, and the William G. Batchelder III Award for the Study of Peace. Please welcome Dr. Sheehan.
If one could name the quintessential activity of the American people from the 1600s to today, it would be the act of association. And if one could name the quintessential right in the American constitutional order, it would be the right of association. Alexis de Tocqueville famously observed, of all countries in the world, America has taken greatest advantage of association and has applied this powerful means of action to the greatest variety of objectives. He continues, Americans of all ages, of all conditions, of all minds constantly unite. Not only do they have commercial and industrial associations in which they all take part, but also they have 1,000 other kinds, religious, moral, intellectual, serious ones, useless ones, very general and very particular ones, immense and very small ones. Americans associate to celebrate holidays, establish seminaries, build inns, erect churches, distribute books, send missionaries to the antipodes. In this way, they create hospitals, prisons, schools. If, finally, it is a matter of bringing a truth to light or of developing a sentiment with the support of a good example, they associate. Associations, Tocqueville saw, were the all-encompassing means of self-government for Americans day to day. The function of association for self-government was present at least from the landing of the Mayflower and the Mayflower Compact, where pilgrims lost on their way to Virginia formed a civic body politic of their own volition. The action continued with towns springing up all through New England. Massachusetts Bay Colony began to recognize them through incorporation in 1636, but it didn't create them. The people forming the towns themselves established their own covenants and local communities. The colonial government merely recognized what the people had done already in association. During the American War for Independence, town meetings as well as colonial assemblies were suspended, but local government did not cease as the British had intended it should. Americans met anyway in parallel shadow governments at all levels, where American communities up and down the eastern seaboard decided what they would do about their troubles with the mother country. During and after the war, various ad hoc committees formed to advocate for particular issues or purposes. This concretized the practice of voluntary association for collective decision making around narrow purposes or issues. Alongside these political activities, shortly after the war, there was an explosion of voluntary associations governing strictly social relations between group members around all sorts of activities and purposes, playing music, playing games, reading poetry, helping the poor, churches, vocations, what have you, sort of America that Alexis de Tocqueville would observe a few decades later. This form of associating, compacting or covenanting together, generally with a written constitution, is the American way of organizing our social lives, from small civil society institutions, to the townships, to the states, to the federal government, from we the people of the United States to we the people of the First Congregationalist Church of Anywhere USA. Realms of politics, economics, and especially civil society are rife with these institutions, and we are better for it. Really, we are only us because of them. This role of associations in American history makes its tenuous place in contemporary American jurisprudence both concerning and puzzling. While the Supreme Court has recognized a right of association, the protection it has provided is feeble. The right has been reduced from its clear textual location in the Assembly Clause to an appendage of the Speech Clause. In NAACP versus Alabama in 1958, the court first named freedom of association as a constitutional right, but it equivocated on its location. Is it in the First Amendment, or is it part of the bundle of rights included by the court's expanded reading of the 14th? In subsequent cases dealing with the NAACP, the court would locate the freedom of association in the First Amendment, but only as a supplement to other rights. In Roberts versus J.C.'s in 1984, the court again failed to give freedom of association its due, coining the term expressive association to describe the right. Despite the glowing terms in which the court discussed the right of expressive association, it subsequently ruled against the associational rights of the group in question, failing to explain why non-discrimination concerns trump the right of association in the concrete circumstances of the case. Was there even a conflict at all? It isn't clear from the court's opinion. Litigation under the right of expressive association has prevailed on a number of occasions and secured protection for some civil society associations, for example, in Boy Scouts versus Dale. But it also failed in cases like Christian Legal Society versus Martinez, where the court ruled that there was no problem from the perspective of the First Amendment for a public university constrained by the First Amendment, and the court was clear on that, to condition registration of a religious student group that it admit all comers, even those who rejected the religious beliefs and practices of the group. The holding in Martinez, a little more than a decade old, is especially concerning. The court's majority opinion explicitly refused to distinguish between associational protection and speech protection. In short, it held that the speech rights of individuals were not affected by the presence of one who disagreed. It's true as far as it goes, but it fails to address the core question of association, which is the utter devastation of intergroup dynamics by the presence of one who rejects the group's core values and practices that make it what it is. Let me give you an example of why this matters. Anthony Bradley argues in Heroic Fraternities, How College Men Can Save Universities and America, that fraternities are uniquely positioned to address soaring rates of substance abuse, anger, and despair by providing men with the support, friendship, and multiple role models that they need. That sounds great. But the problem is that those would-be bastions of community for struggling men seeking healthy male identity are bereft of constitutional protection. Their function is community, camaraderie, character formation, not expression. Therefore, contemporary First Amendment jurisprudence offers little or no protection. Fraternities have lost repeatedly at the federal level. The court's treatment throughout its jurisprudence, while rightly ruling for the associations on a number of occasions, failed to name the most obvious textual location for the right, the Assembly Clause. Only in the last decade or so have scholars given the history and jurisprudential ramifications of this clause the attention it deserves. As it turns out, the debates over the clause and the First Congress indicate the profound concern for associations among the founding fathers. One objection raised to the inclusion of the Assembly Clause in the Bill of Rights was that the provision was superfluous, so obvious that it was unworthy of inclusion, that it, in the words of one congressman from Massachusetts, listing the right to assembly was demeaning to the dignity of this house to descend to such minutiae. How could one worship, speak, engage in free press, or petition the government without assembling with others? The right of assembly was therefore a redundancy in the text. Congressman John Page of Virginia responded by saying that the right of assembly, true, is, quote, no more essential than whether a man has a right to wear his hat or not, But let me observe to him, he's talking to the congressman from Massachusetts, that such rights have been opposed. People have been prevented from assembling together on their lawful occasions. Therefore, it is well to guard against such stretches of authority by inserting the privilege in the Declaration of Rights. The right to wear a hat was a veiled reference to the founder of my home state of Pennsylvania. In 1670, William Penn was arrested in England for unlawful assembly when he tried to assemble for worship with his fellow Quakers. He refused to remove his hat at the trial. Showing his contempt for what he saw, and the founders agreed, was an illegitimate infringement upon his right of assembly. The image of the arrest of William Penn was worth a half hour of oratory, and the Assembly Clause was saved. It was also given its own space. It was not attached to the other rights, implying independent standards of protection from those for religion, speech, and press. In 2021, in Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in concurrence on the need to revive the Assembly Clause. While not the controlling opinion, of course, it indicates for the first time in decades an opening to develop a jurisprudence of assembly that may give our civil society institutions their constitutional due. There are some things that we could do. First, lawsuits under the Assembly Clause. Excellent amicus briefs for Concerned Women of America, the Beckett Fund, and Americans for Prosperity Foundation have incorporated a more robust understanding of associations and the Assembly Clause into their arguments in a salutary way. Important to this effort is to better define the core concept of associations as communities, to shift jurisprudential focus from expression in the Speech Clause to the association under the Assembly Clause. Here we can look to our own conservative tradition for guidance. Robert Nisbet, one of the leading lights of the early intellectual conservative movement, defines the core need for any community as functional autonomy. He writes, defining this term, "The ability of each major function in the social order to work with the maximum possible freedom to achieve its own distinctive ends. What applies to school or university should apply also to economy, to family, to religion, and to each of the other great spheres of society. Everything must be done to avoid intrusion by some one great institution, such as the political state, into the spheres of other institutions." While no single concept perfectly captures anything, functional autonomy provides a salutary way to shift jurisprudential protection from expression to the core purposes of the group, whatever it might be. It would protect not only expressive associations, but those whose function isn't expression, such as Anthony Bradley's heroic fraternities. The Supreme Court wrote in De Jong versus Oregon in 1937, when it incorporated the Assembly Clause against the states, "The right of peaceable assembly is a right cognate to those of free speech and free press and is equally fundamental. Placing the association of freedom in the Assembly Clause alongside its textual brethren in the First Amendment would require heightened scrutiny, and it would invite an inquiry into the nature of a broad associational autonomy, the ability of groups to govern themselves according to their own internal principles and concerns." Second, alter the way we speak of our civil society institutions to indicate their fundamental importance. This happens when groups are described as public accommodations. The court has pushed back on that. It also happens when the Supreme Court describes tax exemption and deductions for nonprofits, including religious organizations, as subsidies the government chooses to permit because of the important role of such associations in a democracy. The intended compliment is an insult. It gets the priority exactly backwards. Associations do not merely facilitate self-government, they are self-government. Their role in democracy is ancillary to their role in fulfilling their function. The real reason for the deduction regime, I believe, is legislatures' recognition in law of the priority of civil society institutions. When a legislature enables people to withhold a portion of income from taxes that they give to their civil society institutions, the law is recognizing that those social groups are our primary institutions, and the authority of those institutions to tax their members is a commitment prior to the government's authority to tax. The government reduces its tax burden, not as an indirect subsidy to civil society, not as a government benefit, but as recognition that civil society may lay claim to the first fruits of our labor. Our governments are to settle for a cut from what is left over after we have fulfilled our financial obligations to our civil society groups. We, the people, should expect our judicial and policy leaders to speak about civil society institutions as primary groups and expect those leaders to recognize the priority of such relationships in jurisprudence and law. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sheehan.